I'm very happy to invite into the Poets Cove poet Aldo Amparan. And we have his new book here. It's called Brother Sleep. It's a Alice James Book Award winner, which is quite a prestigious prize for a first book. Oh, my God. It's you hit the lottery. I'd like to say, except lottery means that you were just lucky, and you weren't lucky. These are beautiful poems that deserve to win. Well, Aldo, welcome into the Poets Cove.
Thank you so much, Daniel. Thank you so much for having me here.
And we invited a couple of writers into the Cove, as always. It's kind of playing with this format. We have Candace. Candace Duran. And she's a fiction writer and a poet, right, Candace? And she's read your book.
Yes.
And then we have Kalina Gallardo, and you know her already, Aldo. She's also an amazing writer. So welcome to the Cove, Aldo. And let's talk a little bit about when I say you hit the lottery. I mean, you really hit it with this first book. This is an amazing book. It's getting a lot of attention that it deeply deserves. One of the things I love to do about poetry, I'm not a poet myself, at least not in the conventional sense that I write verse, is I love swimming in poetry. I mean, swimming to where I feel my whole body moving, and I just go up and down and follow the language, and I feel like I could swim in this book for a very long time.
Thank you so much. That's beautiful.
And you know what, Aldo? When I knew you as a student, you read a poem to me one time, and I thought, whoa, that's stunning. You were my TA, and one time you were editing a poem that you were doing in Pimentel's class, I believe, and you showed it to, or you read it to me. I go, oh my God, this guy's good. So let me ask you, first of all, how did it feel? Where were you when you found out you won the prize? What were you doing, and how did it feel?
So I was here in my room and I got a call. It was from Joseph Fasano, the poet. And I got really excited. And at first I thought maybe I didn't win, but maybe they wanted to say, because at first the year before I was finalist. So I thought that maybe that is the 2020 award hat. I already had been finalist or something like that. And then they told me that I won, and I was so excited.
And what did you do? Did you go celebrate, or put on headphones and listen to me? What did you do?
I did went to celebrate that night with some friends.
Okay.
Just super excited. I called them, gave them the news.
Wow. That's awesome. How long did it take you to put this book together? Brother Sleep, it's called. How long did it take you to get this book together?
So I started putting it together as a manuscript. Would like to say maybe the last year of the MFA, because at first I went in as a fiction writer.
You did? I didn't know that.
Yes. So my original thesis was going to be a collection of short stories, which I was working with in Alex to committee chair. And something about it was, and especially it was Ocean Wong's Night Sky with Exit Wounds that really made me pursue poetry.
And did you write it when you were in a particular class, and is that why you wrote it?
Some poems I wrote in Sasha Pimentel's class, in Andrea Gote Botero's class, in Rosa Galas's class, I always like to say that one of the probably the earliest poem in the book that I wrote was Primer for a View of the Sea. Mm-hmm. that sequence poem, I wrote it when I was an undergrad. And when I was putting together my thesis, I was looking through old poems and I was like, oh, this is horrible. This is horrible. Right. Oh, I can do something with this. And yeah, that was kind of the origin of the book.
Wow. You know, we call this segment a Poet's Cove, right? Because, you know, there's people that are sitting around listening and joining in occasionally in this conversation. But by poets, I mean fiction writers as well, because there's the fiction writer who writes, you know, very structured, predictable fiction. And then there's the fiction writer that can enter into her language and just follow it and find themselves in a magical place, or a place that seems magical because it's outside of reality. And then they come back, but they do that by following language and image. So they're very much poets in that sense. And mm-hmm. I imagine reading some of these poems, I imagine that you maybe at times just got out of the way and let the poem write itself based on the language or whatever that comes to you.
Yes.
And I wonder if that happened to you when you were writing fiction, or did you have more of a structured thought that kind of impeded that ability to go anywhere?
So with fiction, I always had an idea in my mind of where I wanted to go. And I tried always to follow that. Sometimes the story took me somewhere else. But as opposed to with fiction, I think with story, I was a little bit too stubborn to follow my train of thought, my plans.
In your fiction, you were too stubborn to follow it, or in your poetry?
In my fiction.
And how did that, make the fiction better, or did it make it, did it impede it somehow?
It actually kind of made me procrastinate a lot. Yes, because I wanted to get from one point to another, and I found myself stuck in the middle of that without how to get to that point. And with poetry, I found that I didn't need to get to a point. I just followed my rhythm.
Wow. I teach fiction writing, as you know, and one of the things I try to impress on students who want to write fiction is to write like a poet. Don't worry about whether or not the idea is going to come through. In fact, I used to have this teacher, Steve Yarber. I don't know if you ever heard of him. He's a novelist he's at Boston College or Emory. He used to always tell me, one time I told him, you know, Steve, I have an idea for a story. He goes, hey, there's your problem, Dan Chacon. He had a Southern accent that I'm doing a horrible job of. He said, don't start a story with an idea. And years later, that was maybe 30 years later, I am constantly reinforced by that and understand it. Because when a fiction writer enters a story, they should just follow the language and not care about the logic, and not to try to write an idea or a plot. Do I have an idea of a story where a guy goes to Walmart and gets shot? Seems to be like, well, that guy has no free will. The language has no free will. It inevitably has to end up at Walmart where the character gets shot, whereas poetry has more latitude. And so you should, I bet if you wrote poetry that way, Aldo, you would write some amazing stories.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I do want to come back to that manuscript that I started in my MFA. My short story collection, with this new perspective of writing poetry and writing the language.
Right. You know, one of the, I think, greatest poets that has come along in the last generation is Ocean Vuong. And I had him on the show one time when his first book came out, and it's a great conversation. But his nonfiction book is just amazing. You know, and I imagine that he follows his language. And also Lee Young Lee, who is, you know, always going to be one of my favorite poets, when he wrote his nonfiction book, I forget the name of it, but it was all over the place. It was just, the language was going everywhere. And after a while, I just submitted to it and I swam in that language, and it was a beautiful experience.
Yeah, definitely.
Can we talk a little bit about how Brother Sleep took its shape? There seems to be this kind of brother that his spirit and presence is you know, occupies, you know, a lot of occupies actually a bad word, whose spirit comes out in a lot of these poems. Can you talk about this, how this brother became part of this, the glue that held it together?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are different parts where I came with this concept. The most personal, I'm an only child, so I didn't have a brother. But because of this, when I was a kid, I also have a single mom, mm-hmm. and she worked a lot, so I was on my own a lot, and I always felt this need to form bonds with other people. And because I always wanted to have a brother, I always befriended, like became like best friends with someone and asked, do you want to be my brother?
That's great.
Yes. And when I was in high school, in a certain year, I lost my grandfather, and I lost one of those friends that had become like a brother to me. Mm. And because of this, my grief extended for a long, long period of time. Wow. And I always kept trying to hide it, to be strong and to not show it to my family. And the way I navigated this grief and this period of my life, which was also the period where I was trying to come out of the closet, but I had all these insecurities, right. About perception and masculinity and all that. And all that period is what propelled the original idea for this.
Wow. You know, I imagine a lot of people ask you about your brother after reading this book, believing the brother to be real, which is a compliment, because there really is a presence of that brother throughout the pages, where I can feel his spirit, I can feel his ghost. And so I'm convinced that he exists. And I'm wondering if, because I'm able to imagine the brother, I imagine you're, a dog. You're you're imagining of the brother that oftentimes took on visual representations, you know. And I'm wondering if these visual representations of a brother, you were a kid growing up wanting a brother, if they might have started with childhood. Did you picture the brother you wanted when you were a kid? And how is that image transformed over the years?
I don't know if I imagined a brother, but I always became really close with friends. Mm. And I always wanted a brotherly figure in them.
I see.
Yeah,
I'm fishing in the wrong pond then. That makes a lot of sense. So let's put it, let's fast forward to when you lost the friend who was like a brother. Do you find that your images of him, your memories, your, you know, maybe feelings associated with him are dominating the image that we get as readers of the brother, that he influenced it more maybe than anybody else?
I believe so, but I also wanted the figure of the brother in the book to be different concepts as well. So, for example, in one poem, I'm calling my brother in the brown box died for loving and so right. on and so forth. And I'm picturing more than one brotherly figure in the poems. And then I also take the concept of sleep and his brother death from the Greek myth. Right.
I was just gonna say, let's talk a little bit about sleep. I don't know quite how to ask this question, and it might be a really stupid question. And if it is, that's okay, because we have to allow ourselves to be stupid. But I'm wondering if you have, because there's sleep you know, involved in this, and there's death and there's pain. And a lot of times when somebody is depressed, they just want to sleep all the time. That, you know, and one of the reasons why I think that they want that, not to suggest that you were depressed at all. That's not even where I'm going, so don't worry about that. But I'm wondering if you have experienced, or how you've experienced, the hypnagogic state where you're between sleep and awake, and those images just kind of come to you involuntarily. And if that's an experience that you've allowed to influence the way you write or the images that you come up with.
Definitely. Yes, I did struggle with depression after that period for a while. And what I found is that I wasn't so much always wanting to sleep, but I did suffer a lot from insomnia. So I would wake up in the middle of the night with anxiety and couldn't fall back to sleep.
Tormented by your thoughts.
In that state, sometimes that happened, the images. Right. And I always tell my students when I teach imagery and poetry that dream images are so important to bring out the strangeness in poetry and bring out the uniqueness and the freshness.
Yeah, there's this image that you have in one of your poems that just haunted me and still kind of haunts me. It's on the poem about the prison in Mexico City. What is the title of that poem again? It's
Interrogation of the Sodomite.
What page is it on?
9, I believe.
Page 9. Okay, thank you. And so here it is. This just haunts me. I love this image. Actually, I'm thinking about the wrong poem. It's the poem about, sorry about that. It's about where the blue comes in. I think it's about the brother, or it's about, anyway, you're talking about somebody who, I'm not going to say it as elegantly as you, but maybe if I say it, you'll know what I'm referring to. I didn't want to underline your book because it's so beautiful. I didn't want to do that. But it's where the guy in prison, I think he's in a prison, vomits. And it's the description of that blue.
His inside. Oh, yes. Is it Black Palace Blues?
Yeah, yeah. What page is that on? Yes. Black Palace Blues. I want to read that just that line.
Because it's on 53.
Yeah. Thank you. 53. Yeah. So, okay. So here is the line. It says, blue. And it goes, blue like Marcelo's lungs spraying the floor. Oh, my God. That's just such a powerful image. And it haunted me. And you have these images like that that aren't what you would normally see in the waking state, but like images that you need to travel. You know, some might call it the astral plane, some might call it the hypnagogic state. But you seem to have access to this dream imagery that normal people don't have access to. How do you get there? I'm wondering how do you get there, and how do you trust it and say, oh no, that's stupid, that doesn't make sense.
Thank you so much for those comments. I want to say that from my own dreams, my own dreaming, but also from film. So movies became, when I was younger, one of those escapes from the loneliness and all of that. And I always loved unusual imagery in movies. Up to this date, I'm always like super into surreal cinema and all that.
Wow. Like what? Give us an example.
One of my favorite movies is Schenectady, New York.
What is it called?
Schenectady, New York.
Schenectady.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I was trying to form a meaningful word with what you were saying. I couldn't picture it. Schenectady. Oh, wow. And why?
So it's actually... So it's Schenectady, as in the city Schenectady, but it is also Schenectady, like the literary technique of representing the part with the whole with the part.
Oh, I don't know that term. I suppose I should as a professor of creative writing. And so does that theme fit in with the images and the narrative through line, whatever it may be?
So this movie is deals a lot with mortality. And I used one of the lines in that movie as the title of the last poem in the book.
Wow. Really? Can I read that line?
Yeah, of course. Like it,
is it burning into each other's breath? Which is to
say, I know it's the title.
Oh, the title.
This room will still exist.
Oh, I love that title too. That is one of my, that's awesome. You know, when I came out with my novel, my very first novel years ago, when you were not even born, I didn't know what I was going to call it. And I was watching this movie about this guy who was this famous cellist in, you know, 19th century France or something like that. I think it was with Gérard Depardieu. But the line was, somebody was telling about this image of this person and says, and then the shadows took him. And I'm like, that's it. And the shadows took him. Although I didn't really like the movie. I like that line. So I could totally understand that. But I'm going to have to watch that. You know, my problem with movies is I want movies to be entertainment, and I haven't quite developed the sophistication of watching movies for art's sake, which is something I need to overcome, because I know there's a lot of beautiful, beautiful works out there. So a lot of how you have what Lorca calls the poetic logic, right? Or the poetic imagination, where you can access images like that, not have to beat the crap out of them and to get some sort of meaning out of them. Is this how you think? Is this how a poet thinks? Like when you walk from one building to another on campus where you're going to teach a class, you know, do you allow yourself to interact with weird images? Or I don't know. I want to know what it's like to be you.
sometimes, yeah. And I also use a lot of everyday imagery mixed in with that, sort of to ground the poem, the reader. Right. So I guess it deals both ways. Like I take everyday imagery into my poetry, and I take dream imagery into my life.
Wow, you're like a mystic. Seriously, that's what mystics do. If you look at the archetypal mystic Swedenborg, he would walk around without having slept for 3 days. He'd walk around the streets of London and he would hallucinate and really thought they were angels and wrote, you know, thousands of pages on his experience. I think that's beautiful. I'm trying to be able to more access that space. And one of the things that I'm doing is I used to write in the morning, but what I'm realizing now about myself that took me, you know, this long to realize is that in the morning I'm logical and I'm structured. So now I'm writing at night, and those dream images come into my work, and it's just enriching it so much. When do you write? What time of day?
This time around I'm writing more in the morning. But when I wrote this book, I wrote at night, late at night.
Like, can you tell us a little bit about your writing process?
There's a lot of reading involved.
Let's double click on that. What do you mean?
So whenever I want to write a poem, I try to keep books of poetry of the poets that I admire most near me, so I can access some sort of inspiration. I think that that's important to have your literary mentors by your side.
Right. I love that image. I could see it. What popped into my mind is Aldo right there with all these great poets, the spirits of great poets surrounding yes. them. Yeah, that's awesome. And so who is in your, I don't want to say pantheon, but whose spirits are surrounding you? You know, whose poetry is surrounding you that you could just reach and grab and open?
Definitely Lorca, Ocean Vuong, definitely.
Have you met him yet? You've met him, right?
Not in person.
Not in person.
I was present with the in the Words on a Wire interview with him.
Oh, you were in that interview. Okay, all right, cool. Cool. That was a long time ago.
Because
you were a graduate student back then. Okay, so you have Ocean Vuong, you have Lorca. Who else is surrounding you?
Natalie Diaz.
Oh my God. Yeah, she's amazing.
Yes.
Yeah, she can transform me. Absolutely. Who else?
Let's see.
Well, you know, it's interesting that everybody that you've mentioned except for one is a living young poet. And I think that's what makes your poetry, one of the reasons your poetry is so fresh, because you're reading young, brilliant poets and not just the dead poets. One of the lamentations I have about creative writing, some of my students in creative writing undergraduate classes, brilliant people. I mean, there's no question about it. But every class I've ever had, I've always asked them to name a poet at the beginning of the class. And most of them couldn't name a poet. Which is weird. Whereas if I asked that, you would say Natalie Diaz, Ocean Vuong, these just incredible poets that are putting out, you know, really changing, influencing poetry today.
Yes.
How does it feel to be part of that? Also, I'm sorry, what were you gonna say?
And I also try to have as much living, working poets right now in my syllabus when I'm teaching.
Absolutely. How does it feel now to be among them? Because you are, this is your first book. You are really at the level now of Natalie Diaz and Ocean Vuong, just starting out. How does it feel to be a part of that community?
I don't know. I guess I find it hard to feel that way.
Good.
yeah. I guess it's my little imposter syndrome working. But yeah, I still can't imagine myself in those places.
Yeah. Let's go down that path a little bit further when it comes to imposter syndrome. And this is something that I know as a Chicanx writer and one who was, like, my first job as a professor, the first day security followed me from my car to the building because I was parking in the faculty lounge, in the faculty parking. And, you know, these kind of things are things that we've had over and over before. And you, as a Latinx growing up on the border, your sexual orientation is very hard for you to struggle with when you were a kid. You have this poem in this book about these school kids picking on the speaker of the poem and calling him, what was that word that they call him for gay? I forget. I'd never heard of that word in that context.
Is it the puñal?
Puñal, yes, yes. What was the word they were calling him?
It would be a derogatory term in Spanish, but it has two meanings. So it would mean like a knife or a dagger.
Right.
And then it would be a slur for gay men.
Right. But you know, all these upbringings that we have that continually knock us down, you know, we as Latinx people, as people oppressed, as women, begin to develop what Lorna D. Cervantes calls the nagging feeling that I'm not good enough. And so when we become as successful as you are, we do feel like maybe I faked my way in here. You know, maybe I'm not smart enough. Maybe I'm really not good enough. And I know right now, although that never goes away, I have it now. And I'm 60 years old and I've been in this business for a long time. It never goes away. But it's your strength. It's your strength because it keeps you humble and keeps you reading voraciously and keeps you wanting to learn more and more. It's common. It really is, you know, among people like you who are so successful or are beginning to enter into the world of success. What are you right now? You're a visiting professor at NMSU, which has an amazing MFA program. Can you tell us about your position there?
Yes. This is my second semester teaching there. I'm teaching two classes right now. I taught a graduate class last semester.
First time?
Yeah. Yes.
Were you scared as hell when you walked in there the first day?
Yes, and that would be again my imposter syndrome. Like I was so afraid that these graduate students would know a lot more than me and would like challenge that.
Right. Yeah, especially when the first time I walked into a graduate class as a professor. Yeah, it's like I was so scared, and I thought these students, yeah, they're going to know much more than me. And I realized almost immediately they did know much more than me, but I knew different things that they didn't.
Yeah, definitely.
So how did the class go?
Great. It was a very small class. I had 4 students, so it was a very intimate class, and the class was three hours.
Wow.
So 3 hours, 4 students. I was just so worried about time, about running out of things to say. But yeah, they were so so participative that it was wonderful.
Do you know, sometimes when you have the imposter syndrome, it might take you half a semester before you start feeling, okay, yeah. But other times when you go in there, immediately you're in your element, you're there, and another you takes over, and then the imposter syndrome, you might analyze it later and look for weaknesses, but while you're in the moment, you're in flow. Did it take you a while to get to that, or was that just an immediate thing?
I guess my experience at UTEP helped a lot with that, especially the last few semesters. I did gain a lot of confidence in my teaching there. So yeah, I kind of took that in, and I did bring a lot of my syllabus to NMSU. So that helped a lot, and yeah.
Wow. Well, are you going to stay there for a while, or what are your plans? If you don't mind my asking, do you know what you're going to do? I imagine you're getting a lot of invitations to do readings and to participate in workshops.
Not as much as I would like. But yeah, I have a few invitations, and I do plan on eventually applying for a tenure track position. But yeah, I hope that I can teach one more year at NMSU before I do that.
All right. And I was hoping that you would be able to read us one of the poems from the book. I'd love to hear you read, because when I read it in my voice, and I've read it to my students in my senior seminar, when I read it in my voice, it just sounds so beautiful. But that's probably my ego talking, because the poems are beautiful. So I'd love to hear you read it. I'd like to know what it sounds like, because your poems sound really cool. Would you read one?
Of course. Is there any particular one that...
The one that you read the best, or that you like reading the most, unless anybody else has a request.
I would love to hear a reading of Thanatophobia, or Sleep Addresses His Brother, if you don't mind.
Oh, that is a good one. That is a good one. That's, yeah, absolutely. Is that okay, Aldo?
Of course.
What page is it on for those who are following in the Missalette? You could tell I was a Catholic kid, you know, page 46 on the Missalette, and I'm still doing that exegesis of beautiful texts. What page is it on?
Page 15.
Thanatophobia, or Sleep Addresses His Brother. And this has an epigraph by Federico García Lorca, which reads, "No duerme nadie por el mundo." Night, the world boils. Men toss sleepless in their sheets like stars, because I look down where a man holds his only son among the spillage of buildings and children sitting on the debris after the bombs cast their shadows onto stone. There the boy hangs from his father's arm, his father's hand folded to the open neck, and the open eyes like cold nickels look past me, past the white sheet of linen. How terrible the fabric that veils the end. How terrible the night for him, the sleepless brother. When an American soldier swallows a grenade which bursts as it slips down his throat, a Mexican immigrant, a woman beaten half to death for stealing a pomegranate, breaks the fruit skin open, red from her wounds like the inside of the fruit or the inside of the soldier. And doctors put to sleep a girl to replace her heart with a new beating. Soon that artificial sleep turns the same terrible fabric. Her mother, quiet as a desert in the hall, admires Wojnarowicz's untitled buffalo, that great beast at the edge of the photograph, suspended in air forever. And the girl's father reaches her mother's arms to keep her from plunging off the rooftop to fall into you, brother. I know nothing but impermanent rest. How do you do it? Each time you take and wrap your permanence around sleep. Brother, you terrify me. You make my heart gallop like buffaloes in the white desert, their large bodies advancing their fall.
Thank you. Thank you. I that first image the father and the child, is that the initial seed image of this, or is it another one of the images?
So this poem started with the idea of sleep looking down into the world and seeing all the tragedies. So at first I was describing all the setting where they were, but then I instantly noticed that it was my little fiction writer trying to do setting and all that into it. And it was preventing the language from flowing. So this was the project for that.
So you had to kick the fiction writer out of the room, out of the poetry room. That's great. And another way of saying that is you had to kick out the logical side, you know, the side that makes choices and just let the poem free. And it is free. It goes all over the place. I love the images. And then you have a quote by García Lorca. And I can't help but think of García. Every time I think of García Lorca, I think about that speech he made in Buenos Aires, you know, where he first talked about the play and theory of the duende. And and how the duende, for me, has become a symbol of not only that dark spirit in the art, and I know I've seen that dark spirit in you occasionally. There's, you know, and you sometimes you wear it, and I think it's a beautiful it's a beautiful aura to have, but it's not just darkness, that dark spirit that we allow into the work and allow it to fight against the form or to fight against the little fiction writer and beat the fiction writer's ass, but it's also rooted in a lot of pain. And I'm wondering, you know, some of these poems are just so painful for me, and I didn't even experience them other than the visceral experience of reading your poetry. I'm wondering if some of these poems were difficult for you to write, and maybe you had to, like, escape and then go back and escape, or did you just go right in?
Yeah, definitely they were. There was this period in my life where I was so scared of vulnerability, of showing my pain, of people noticing my pain. So whenever I felt like crying or was upset, I always locked myself in. And I was with this book, and then my next book that I'm trying to write, I'm trying to channel the most vulnerable moments in my life. That was kind of like the purpose, to defeat that fear of vulnerability in me.
And which poems in this book were the hardest to, because they were the hardest to write?
Probably Elegy with a Dialogue Connection. what I say to my mother after her father dies is soft. So mostly because I attempted to make the brother figure a little bit more universal. The poems about my grandfather, which are very specific, tend to be the ones that I found really the hardest to write.
Right. Well, it's good that you're willing to go there, because I know one of the things that a lot of poets have to overcome is that fear of where it's going to go. And the thing about that fear is sometimes we don't know that it's a fear of pain, of releasing the duende, releasing the kraken, and we mistake it for these voices that tell us, oh, that's not very logical, or nobody's going to like that, or that makes no sense, you know, all these different voices that protect us from the pain, but you just go right for it. And I imagine it's because you're a poet, a real poet. So you mentioned a book that you're working on. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I'm working on, the tentative title is The House Has Teeth. And it is exploring the dichotomy between horror movies and violence in movies versus the violence in real life, mm-hmm. border violence. And I'm also exploring child sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. So that would be another vulnerable moment in my life,
yeah.
in my path. So I'm exploring those themes. And
yeah, I expect you will get visited by Duende as you're doing that. Do you ride in the dark, or do you like a lot of light?
I do like dim light, like a little bit of darkness.
Right. You can see better in the dark sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
Aldo, I have a question for you in terms of language. Mm-hmm. Something that is repetitious in your work is this sort of like play with the idea of a glossary and what feels like the creation of language for the story that needs to be told versus perhaps how the word has functioned prior. So I'd love to know about how you break language and perhaps how you use language to build something new.
Thank you for that question, Polina. So yeah, the glossary poem started by this idea of, actually there were an exercise that I put myself when I was a little blocked. So I started looking for words in the dictionary and looking for their definitions, and then taking those definitions and trying to make a little more of the poetic sense to them. Mm-hmm. So taking out the actual definition and trying to say, where does the words lead me to? And so that's how the glossaries started. And yeah, the language, I think when you allow the language to guide you, that's when you're not paying attention to grammar, for example, to syntax, you're just letting the sounds and the images guide you. And that's how I feel like language works best in poetry.
Do you keep a physical dictionary by your side, or is it you go online and look up a word?
I used to keep a physical dictionary, but when I wrote these poems, I did use the Oxford English Dictionary online.
Mm, okay. And do you ever like to pick up a dictionary the way you pick up a book of poems and just kind of randomly and go to a page and read a word?
Well, I didn't do it randomly, but I think that's also a great exercise.
Right. Yeah, that would be bad to do in a class. Yeah, to have them open up a dictionary, if anybody even has a physical dictionary anymore. Does anybody else have anything to say before we say goodbye to Aldo? The name of the book is Brother Sleep, available where all good books are sold. Especially, they got, I know, 1,000 copies at Literarity Bookstore right here in El Paso. So if you're local, I would go buy it there. And they're signed copies. So short of that, where would you prefer people to buy your books?
Definitely Literarity. They're so nice. Bill is so nice there. Maybe if that's not an option, from Alice James, the website would be really, really good.
Nice. Cool. Excellent. And anything else before we say goodbye to our Candace, you look like you want to ask a question, but you're imposing the imposter syndrome on yourself. Quit doing that. What's your question?
I was actually trying to formulate the question because there's a lot I want to say, but I can't. First off, I mean, I just like admire this piece of art as very kind of very personal, and I admire how you were able to take very sometimes controversial and very sensitive topics and translate them in like a way that is just so palpable. And that's just something that I admire and want to like get to. So first off, that's what like touched me the most about reading this book. And I also found it very endearing how you were able to really go and push yourself in, I mean, what I imagine is probably really difficult memories, or even if it's not a memory, difficult, I don't know, environments, I guess. Mm-hmm. Like, and I found it really brave. And I'm really like, I'm just trying to learn from you as much as I can. Like, because I have that barrier, you know, and I you make it look so easy in your writing, because it's so like water, you know. All like right. Drinking water. So
I love that. Like water, you're drinking it, I'm swimming in it.
Yeah. That's yeah, awesome. I'm just trying to take in as much as I can. And so I guess I don't really have a question. I just wanted to say wow.
Wow, that's great.
And so I mean, I guess I have a question, but describe your writing flow. Like what works for you?
I think starting with a word and then following what the next word.
Where one
the
word?
Yeah.
Wow. That I would never have guessed that.
Or even a title. Uh-huh. And then the title might guide.
Wow. You know, I would love to write a poem and give it to you and have you analyze it, which isn't, I'm not going to do it. Don't worry. I know you're busy. But what I mean is, I imagine your students are really getting a lot from you by, you know, getting your feedback. And as you know, I'm teaching the senior seminar this year, which is the culmination of the creative writing degree here at UTEP. We have a department of creative writing with an undergraduate degree, and it's the culmination. And I'm using your book, and the students love it, and I can't wait for you to come and visit us. And thank you for agreeing to do that. They're very excited.
Thank you for inviting me.
And I'm sure they're going to have a lot of questions. And, but yeah, congratulations on this book, Aldo. You should have told me when you were working for me that you were such a great writer. Then I would have just had you just write all my stories. I think you need to return to fiction, but not with the little fiction writer. Leave him out of it. And I bet you would write some amazing things, because that poem you just read to us, you had a buffalo image at the end, and and that buffalo image came a little bit before in parentheses. And my question is, I don't suspect when you used buffalo the first time that you knew you were going to end with buffalo, but that somehow you have the instinct to bring images back, and every time you bring them back, you deepen them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that'll serve. Okay, go ahead.
That is actually something that I learned from screenwriting, to have setups and payoffs.
Right. In comedy, it's called the callback.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And
yeah, I use that in my poetry too.
Right.
A lot.
Because then you have the first image of buffalo was really, you know, in the parentheses, I almost saw the buffalo, you know, contained, but then later the buffalo became a beast, right? And so the first time it's an image, the second time it's a motif, whether the writer wants it to be or not, it's going to become a motif. Because you do that on the level of craft, and I imagine you do it on the level of intuition as well, I think that if you were to write, here I am trying to convince you to write another story, if you were to write fiction in that manner, and after you're done, you would see the connections, and in revisions, you would have such a good time making those connections.
Yeah.
So.
And actually, that image is borrowed. This is a little bit frantic moment in the poem, from David Bojarowicz's photograph.
Right, right. Well, all images are not borrowed; they're accessed. We access images. I think that's what I learned from Lorca. You know, Lorca has this beautiful poem about gypsies on the crossroad, dancing on the crossroad. I don't know if you remember that poem. I forget the title of it, but it's a beautiful poem. And when I enter into those crossroads and watch those gypsies dancing, there's this sudden realization that I have that I am connected to others who have come to crossroads and watched gypsies dancing or Mexican women dancing or indigenous women dancing or country women dancing or just the image of women dancing at the crossroads connects us. I don't know where I'm going with that. Thank you, Aldo, for joining us in the Poet's Cove. We call it the Poet's Cove, but we have a little N in parentheses because it's also, in a sense, the Poet's Coven. And what we mean by that is not that we're witches, but that we're, Candace stirring the pot. That we think of ourselves as witches, but when poets come together and are able to share conversation and ideas and goodwill, magic happens. And so thank you for being part of the Poet's Cove or the Poet's Coven, whichever you're more comfortable with.
Thank you so much for having me. And I love that. I love the Poet's Coven.
All right. We're in the coven then. Today we're in the coven. When I have like a physicist on the show or neuroscientist, they always choose Cove. Which makes sense, right? Okay, well, thank you, Aldo. Thank you, my ex-student, Will Rose. Thank you to these brilliant writers who are learning from you and who we will learn from when their books come out, Kalinda Gallardo and Candice Duran. I'm Daniel Chacon. See you next time on the Poet's Cove. Coven, depending on the guest. Next guest actually is going to be Jessa Crispin, who is the writer of The Creative Tarot. She's a poet who teaches these workshops on how to use tarot cards to inspire and to access parts of the imagination that are apparently come very easily to Aldo, but not maybe to the rest of us. So look out for that book. Her book is called The Creative Tarot. Thank you, Aldo. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.